With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. Water users in Scott and Shasta watersheds discuss potential flow mandates. Farmers, ranchers, tribal members, and others who rely on water from the Scott River and Shasta River watersheds turned out a couple weeks ago to offer insight to state officials considering an emergency regulation to set minimum flows on the tributaries. The gathering at an informal workshop on October 6th in Sacramento came up in response to a July 1st petition by the Karuk tribe. The petition seeks permanent minimum in-stream flows to prevent the extinction of the coho salmon. That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report, and now let's get into today's show headlines. Workplace violence prevention rule signed by the governor. There's a new legislation that targets workplace violence. AgSafe president and CEO Teresa Keene shares more.
The governor signed this bill, the Workplace Violence Prevention Bill. It was SB 553 in September. And while the legislature was working on this and it got passed, Cal OSHA was also at the same time working on a standard as well. And so it just kind of fast forwarded the timeline a bit more. And so workplaces are going to need to have a workplace violence prevention plan included in their IIPP, or it could be a standalone program, but that's going to be required for employers by July 1st of this next year.
Keene says the specifics of how the legislation and Cal OSHA's requirements mesh up together still need to be ironed out.
Well, you know, Cal OSHA is still kind of working through all the finer details. They've got something put together. And so I know now they're taking the new legislation and incorporating that into what the regs are going to be. But we do know that every operation is going to need to like essentially assess their operation and figure out what the threats are to their workplace.
For updates and how to stay compliant, you can always visit Cal OSHA's website. And now here's Brian German with more Ag News.
With data collection becoming more advanced in new ag technologies, the next step in that process will be turning that information into automated action. CEO of Pacific Ag Rentals, Bart Walker, said the next evolution of smarter ag equipment will need to be able to take more decisive action on farms.
If, let's say, we have an autonomous tractor, I want that autonomous tractor to tell me, hey, something broke in the back and I have stock. Well, don't call me. Call my mechanic and let him know. You can send me a flag if you want to, but help me with this decision process. If you know that the tractor knows that a mechanic is going to be needed for this, call them. If it's out of fuel, running low on fuel, go park somewhere and call the fuel guy. Don't call me. Call the fuel guy. So now I'm getting my processes handled for me in the automation world. So in car driving, we have five different levels of automation, 1 through 5. 1 is very rudimentary. It's almost cruise control. 2 is hands-off like Tesla and Chevy have right now. 3 is just Mercedes just got approved for that. So you can do a little bit more with it. You can kind of take your hands off and not pay as much attention. 4 is an advancement of that. And 5 is hop in the car, sit down and say, take me to McDonald's. Right? That's level 5. So we have to have that same sort of level of automation with farm equipment coming through and being able to stop, make those decisions for you, and have smart equipment too.
The UC Davis Department of Viticulture and Enology will be hosting a grape seminar next month. The event will take place on Thursday, November 16th at the UC Davis Conference Center. Table Grape Advisor Joy Hollingsworth will begin the program with a presentation on biostimulant use in raisin grapes. Other topics of discussion will include linking ground-based and remote measurements of vineyard water use and stress, vineyard plasticity and changing conditions, and countywide blue-green sharpshooter trapping in Sonoma and Napa. Viticulture Farm Advisor Carl Lund will also be presenting an evaluation of nematode-resistant rootstocks in the San Joaquin Valley. After lunch, presentations will be covering topics such as improving weather data for addressing frost, heat, and spray drift risks, impacts of cordon height on grape production, and grapevine nitrogen retrieval by remote sensing. More information about the UC Davis Grape Day is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Irrigation in arid California is as complicated as it is essential. Unpredictable supplies, uneven distribution, complicated application schedules, and regulation make it a challenge. No wonder help with water is the biggest request at USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service. Since 2014, NRCS has invested over $100 million helping over 1,000 California farmers conserve water. By using superior technology and savvy management, farmers get more crops with fewer drops. Join the Water Savings Club. Contact your local NRCS office. NRCS, helping people help the land since 1935.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, a steady stream of ships is hauling grains and metals from Ukraine a month after the first inbound vessel sailed through its new shipping corridor in the Black Sea in defiance of Russian threats. Matt Ammerman, Commodity Risk Manager, Vice President of Eastern Europe, Black Sea Region with StoneX Financial, gave an update during a webinar hosted by the Northern Crops Institute.
This is a good thing. Obviously, they're not being hit by anything. There was one that got hit by a mine, I believe it was last week. But again, the market just didn't really care about it because it's amazing the resilience of Ukraine, how quick they go back to operating. But right now, most of these vessels are a mix of products. But there are rumors of anywhere from 10 to 30 cargoes that China bought of Ukraine corn. So I guess we just wait to see how much exactly that is. But this is good for Ukraine. If you look at farmers, what they get paid, freight rates from Odessa versus the Danube ports are much cheaper, to the tune of roughly $40. So as a farmer, you're going to take the risk of selling to the ports, the Ukraine ports, to get you a better price versus Danube. So think of it, the farmers kind of has a more or less free $40 put option, if you might consider that, via better prices. So that's where you're seeing some aggressive selling from the Ukraine side because of the better price they're able to get via the ports.
Ammerman says farmers in Ukraine are in the process of planting winter wheat. There are unanswered questions about potential corn and sunflower acreage next spring.
The idea is that the farmer in Ukraine is struggling financially. If you're a farmer, you understand you can't do three back-to-back years of bad years. Well, Ukraine is kind of on that third year at this point. But ironically, somehow they just get it done. And they always lean optimistic. So I think they still plant near the same as what they planted this past year on corn. Crop rotations, yes, you can maybe see a little bit more go to sunflower. Sunflower seed is something very highly regarded in Ukraine. So you can maybe see a little bit more of that, but it's amazing the resilience. Just like U.S. farmers, they like corn. Ukraine, they like it as well. So I don't see us really changing drastically that much versus this past year.
Earlier this month, the Ukrainian government said Russia has destroyed almost 300,000 metric tons of grain since July in attacks on Ukraine's port facilities and on ships, underscoring the war's threat to global food security. In other news, the never-ending legal fight over EPA's wetlands jurisdiction and which ones are waters of the U.S. is likely to live up to its reputation. That's from the testimony at a Senate hearing. The Environmental Protection Agency's vagueness in a final Waters of the U.S. rule intended to conform to the Supreme Court's May decision in Sackett versus the EPA, but will only lead to more lawsuits. Former EPA Assistant Administrator for Enforcement Susan Bodine says the agency did not end the significant nexus wetlands test from its original January rule.
But in the preamble in January 23, again, that you can say something is relatively permanent just if you see a bed and bank, just if you see like wet leaves. That's the same test that had been used in the past to identify a stream, even a stream or a channel that only has water when it rains.
A vagueness, the American Farm Bureau complained last month, would upend the point of two Supreme Court cases and decades of litigation by half the states and farm groups to end EPA's wetlands uncertainty. Bodine agreed.
They could have written bright lines in their conforming rule and chose not to. I do think that the agencies are trying to hold on to as much jurisdiction as, you know, that they wanted.
That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, USDA's latest look at milk production and prices noted demand for butter and its impacts on the supply and demand ledger. Rod Bain has more details.
Minimal changes in USDA domestic dairy production forecasts for both 2023 and 24.
2023 production we raised slightly, up just about 100 million pounds. Didn't make any change to our 2024 milk production forecast, but that 2023 increase is just reflecting a little bit of a bump up in milk per cow.
World Agricultural Outlook Board Chair Mark Jankowski says demand for butter is a driver behind dairy supply and demand estimates.
Fat basis imports unchanged for 2023, but up a bit for 2024. That is reflecting increased imports of butter. Similarly, our export forecast on fat basis were lowered. In both cases, that reflects lower U.S. exports of butter.
Most category prices are up, minus cheese, translating in reduction in Class 3 milk prices. Class 4 prices, however, were adjusted up both for this year and next. Bottom line, higher all milk prices forecasted for both years. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Thanks, Rod. And World Ag Outlook Board Chair Mark Jankowski reviews USDA's latest forecast for milk category and class prices.
Cheese prices are actually down a bit. We reduced our cheese price forecast by 4 cents per pound, reflecting relatively abundant supplies there and stable demand. So lowered by 4 cents a pound in both 2023 and 2024. Class 3 prices reduced for both years, reduced by 30 cents per hundredweight and 35 cents per hundredweight, respectively, reflecting those lower cheese prices. And then the Class 4 prices, on the other hand, were raised. For 2023, we raised our Class 4 price forecast by 65 cents per hundredweight. For 2024, we increased that Class 4 price by 80 cents per hundredweight. And in both cases, that reflects strength in the butter market, also to some extent non-fat dry milk market. When you look at what that implies for the all milk price for 2023, we raised it by 30 cents per hundredweight, currently forecast at $20.70 per hundredweight. For 2024, we raised the all milk price forecast by 25 cents per hundredweight, currently forecast at $20.55 per hundredweight, down just 15 cents per hundredweight year over year.
Again, that was World Ag Outlook Board Chair Mark Jankowski. And live weights of both hogs and cattle ran below year earlier weights for the early part of this year. Hog live weights averaged 284.9 pounds through the week ending July the 8th. That compares to 287.3 pounds during the same time last year. That's an average difference of over 2.4 pounds. They note lower weights this year are likely because of producer losses caused by high feed cost and low hog prices due to weaker pork demand. Now, when it comes to cattle, live cattle weights average 1,370 pounds at 16.25 pounds less than over the same period last year. They note lower weights are caused by a variety of factors, including more heifers with lower weights in the slaughter mix and ongoing drought conditions. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West.
You're listening to Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
There's a new partnership for early detection of animal diseases. That's coming up on This Land of Ours.
It's a new partnership among the nation's animal health and biodefense facilities to improve early detection of emerging animal diseases. This is Christy Loyacato, coordinator of the National Animal Health Laboratory Network within USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service.
We're going to identify five scientists and place them in five of our non-laboratories around the country with the intent of them to take their region, look at the threats both nationally and internationally, do risk assessments, and then make sure that the laboratories that are non-laboratories within their region have the capability to respond to those threats.
Chosen non-facilities will partner with the National Bio and Agro-Defense Facility, NBAF. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Sabrina Halverson for Agnet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCullough. When co-owned farmland is leased, must all of the co-owners agree to lease the property? Must all of them agree to terminate the lease? These questions tend to arise when farmland is left to multiple children as co-owners. When farmland is co-owned, each co-owner has distinct title. That means that an absentee owner is entitled to receive the reasonable rental value of the property from the co-owner in possession, consistent with the absentee owner's interest. Another point is that the law presumes that a farm lease is made with the knowledge and consent of each co-owner. That presumption can come into play if a written lease is not signed by all of the owners. All co-owners are bound unless the presumption can be overcome. The issue also arises when farmland ends up being co-owned by the children after the last parent dies. Can one child unilaterally terminate the lease? What if one co-owner owns a much smaller percentage than another co-owner? Can the one with a small ownership percentage block a co-owner with a much larger ownership percentage from either entering into a lease with a tenant or terminating a tenant? If the rights of the co-owner with a small ownership percentage are not materially harmed, it's likely that the other co-owner can enter into and terminate the lease. The courts have not been consistent in answering these questions. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCullough.
The World Food Prize Week of Events starts up the last full week of October in Des Moines, Iowa. Nicole Pranger with the World Food Prize says the goal is to help end world hunger.
Our founder, Dr. Borlaug, said that food is the moral right of all who are born into this world. Everyone needs to understand that and live that way. It doesn't matter who you are, where you're from, or what you think. Everybody in this world deserves to eat.
Pranger says the World Food Prize helps further that goal locally and globally. Starting the week, they will kick off the World Food Prize Week of Events, including the International Conference of the Borlaug Dialogue.
We're going to welcome 1,200 scientists, scholars, students, and food security champions here to Iowa, and we cannot be more thrilled. That includes global farmers, CEOs, two heads of state from African countries, presidents, and two vice presidents. We're having 11 breakout sessions, 30 main stage sessions, fireside chats, 20 CEOs, agribusiness leaders, you name it, they are in the room. And this is the place to have the conversation to help end world hunger.
Pranger adds they are honored to have so many people come together to talk about world hunger, and Iowa is the perfect location.
Iowa is the breadbasket and the heart of America when it comes to farming and agriculture. This is absolutely the place where these people from 76 different countries need to be coming to share their stories, talk about their challenges, and present solutions.
Aside from the Borlaug Dialogue, that week also hosts the Global Youth Institute and then the Laureate Award Ceremony. This year's winner, Heidi Kuhn, is from the U.S. She created Minds to Vines.
She was credited with coming up with this concept of revitalizing farmlands that have been demined. So basically, the mines from war have been taken out of the fields, and then she has worked with farmers across the globe to revitalize those fields and make them fruitful for their families and their communities.
Anyone can register virtually at worldfoodprize.org/register. The Laureate Award Ceremony will be live Thursday night at 6:45 Central. You can watch it online. Just search World Food Prize Live. I'm David Geiger.
Leaves on many trees begin their transformation from the greens of spring and summer to the multiple colors of autumn. But what causes this change? U.S. Forest Service plant physiologist Paul Schomburg says chlorophyll that gives leaves its greens start to fade come the shorter days of fall, giving way to existing yellow protective compounds. Then there is the third, red pigment.
With minor stresses in the fall, they are produced as a new compound when the leaves are actually going to be starting to senesce.
Odd in that the tree is using sugars and nutrients to build the red pigments in dying leaves. Forest Service research of this phenomenon indicates,
because these are protective compounds, they are produced in only some tree species to help protect the leaves to stay on the tree a little longer so that it can reabsorb the remaining sugars and nutrients that are in those leaves.
In part, for use and development of next year's leaves. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
Wall Street continues to watch the Treasury bond market and doesn't like what it sees. I'm Mark Oppold with today's Bottom Line Report brought to you by Kloss Equipment. As we begin this last full week of October, yields on 10-year Treasury bonds crossed above 5% late week. That's the first time in 16 years. Yields have been rising, even with encouraging economic data souring investors on Wall Street. Stock market endured another lower week last week. Elsewhere, December gold starts at three-month highs today, topping $2,000 an ounce on Friday. That's the highest since late July. Strength tied there to events in the Middle East. This is the Bottom Line Report. Maximize your harvest potential with the efficiency, reliability, and affordability of the Kloss Treon 740 Combine. Take a closer look at Kloss.com. Well, after five attempts the last 2 weeks, December corn finally topped $5 on Friday and on very strong trade volume, suggesting that higher highs are coming. Soy oil starts today, four-month highs, catching some soybean traders off guard, we understand. And watch for a breakout on wheat futures this week. That's our bottom line. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day and a profitable week ahead.
The nation's cooperative business model, especially as an important part to rural economies, is celebrated every October.
The National Cooperative Month has been around for almost 60 years.
And there are multiple examples found in rural America of cooperatives and their significance, both the local and national economies. For example,
agricultural cooperatives in particular operate in 10,000 locations in all 50 states and have a long history as a resilient, sustainable business model.
I'm Rod Bain. Andrew Burke and Karama Neal, administrators of two departments within USDA's Rural Development Mission Area that focus on cooperatives, join us as we look at the cooperative connection at the rural level in this edition of Agriculture USA. Every October, a monthly recognition of the importance of the cooperative model of business in our country occurs. And the theme of National Cooperative Month 2023 is Owning Our Identity.
What we want to do this month is really celebrate that identity that they have and the way that they serve communities. It involves more than 30,000 cooperatives of all different types.
That's Andrew Burke, the administrator of the Rural Utility Service, part of USDA's Rural Development Mission Area. RUS has, for well over six decades, partnered with cooperatives that brought essential electric and telecommunication infrastructure and services to rural citizens during that time frame.
We are the biggest funder of water, telecommunications, and electricity at the Rural Utility Service for rural America. And a big piece of what we do is deal with cooperatives.
What perhaps consumers do not understand, however, is the cooperative model of business is prevalent in so many forms, rural as well as urban.
As a child, I used to go to a cooperative health clinic on occasion that my dad was the leader of at one point. You'll see food cooperatives where folks will band together to market different foods. That can be a cooperative. Cooperative farming happens frequently. Financial services, credit unions, which are cooperative. Rural electric cooperatives.
Karama Neal is also part of USDA Rural Development. Her title is Administrator of the Rural Business Cooperative Service, or put another way,
as an agency that has cooperative in the name, we do get excited about National Cooperative Month.
And as for the Rural Business Cooperative Service and its support of rural cooperatives nationwide,
we have a cooperative services branch, which manages quite a bit of our work with cooperatives. They provide technical assistance. They collect statistics on agricultural cooperatives and do just a wide variety of work around cooperatives. We also provide grants directly to certain types of cooperatives through competitive grant-making programs. We also do a lot of financial services work, lending, guaranteeing loans, and those loans sometimes come through credit unions, which of course are cooperatives.
Much of RBCS's work is in partnership with sister USDA rural development agencies, such as the Rural Utilities Service. Also,
the Rural Housing Service guarantees mortgages, many of which are made through credit unions.
As far as what the cooperative model of business looks like, our U.S. Administrator Andrew Burke explains.
Essentially, the big pieces are that a cooperative is owned by its members. There's a democratic process, so the members come in and vote. And it's been around for a long time, and it looks out for people, and it's nonprofit.
And since it is member owners and or businesses who use the services of the cooperative,
then it is looking out for the best need of the people and the businesses it serves.
In issuing its proclamation for National Cooperative Month 2023, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack highlighted some of the key economic statistics associated with cooperatives and their significance to rural economies. RCBS Administrator Crom O'Neill says, for instance,
there are more than 30,000 cooperatives, including agricultural, utility, financial services, purchasing, food, housing, retail, and so much more.
That equates to 73,000 places of business across the country.
These account for more than 2 million jobs and generate more than $700 billion in annual revenues.
In addition, there are agricultural cooperatives located in 10,000 locations nationwide.
And have a long history as a resilient, sustainable business model.
A track record that ties into the theme of owning our identity for National Cooperative Month, a multi-decade identity of service to customers, according to Administrator Neal.
The Cooperative Marketing Act passed in 1926, so we're coming up on almost 100 years that USDA has had some level of focus on cooperatives. And even with that long history, we are very intentional around being innovative, and we encourage people to visit our website, rd.usda.gov.
This has been Agriculture USA. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
GMOs? Genetically engineered? Bioengineered? What's what? Well, GMO stands for genetically modified organism. It's the common term many people use for foods created through a process scientists call genetic engineering. And you'll start seeing bioengineered on some food packages to let you know the product or some of its ingredients come from GMOs. Feed your mind with more GMO knowledge on FDA's website.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
So my name's Roger Belisle, and I am the agronomic service rep for Northern California for Syngenta, basically the field agronomist.
And number one, first and foremost, there's a recent announcement just a couple weeks ago that almond growers have a new material that's available to them. So let's kind of start there with what that is.
So we have Miravis Prime available now. It's just recently registered. As many know, we've had Miravis Duo for quite a while for almonds as well. But now we have Miravis Prime. It's a higher load of adapinin. And then you have that group 12, the Flutie, which is not available in any other product in the market. So you have a really good economical product that you can put out there. It's a great bloom time application. And you're going to get really good efficacy at a great price.
And for those that might not be familiar with it, I mean, what's it effective on? What's it combat? What's it do?
So, I mean, Miravis Prime is it's a broad spectrum, so it's going to cover most of the usual suspects as far as fungal diseases on almonds. So, you know, you're gonna hit the early brown rot, blossom blight. You know, you're also going to get shot hole. You also can hit alternaria later, although, you know, we would time that later, obviously, if we were gearing towards that. But, you know, the spectrum of foliar fungal diseases for almonds.
And for this being, like you said, it is the only one that's in that particular group. What's the importance of making that available to growers and having that available to them?
So by including this group 12, you're able to rotate this product in, and you're basically managing resistance. You don't want to be using the same product or the same frac group season in and season out. When you do that, you're going to develop resistance in the population on whatever pathogen you're trying to knock down, and you're going to have more and more problems in the future. It's going to basically show less efficacy over time. So by including that group 12, even if you say you use Miravis Prime one season and you use a competitor or another, you should still rotate that in because you're going to get that resistance management.
And obviously, getting anything registered requires quite a bit of data and information behind it. I won't ask you to give me specific numbers or anything without having that directly in front of you. But, I mean, what are some of the results that you are seeing with some of the data up to this point in terms of how efficacious it is?
So, specifically on some of the spring foliar diseases, we found that it worked as well, if not better, than the competitors. Economical product and a really effective treatment. All the data supports it working well and knocking down, in some cases, significant pressure, knocking down incidence to zero or close to zero. So very little incidence after application.
And then anything else I might have missed or something you want to highlight with it or something else that you guys are working on just in general for California growers?
I guess the only thing I would say is with, this new addition to Miravis Prime, some people will have questions, you know, do I apply Miravis Prime or do I apply Miravis Duo? You know, we're almost competing with ourselves. And the takeaway on that would be we think Miravis Prime is a very good bloom application. You kind of get a really strong treatment early on. It's very effective in a number of the fungal diseases at that timing. And then do the Miravis Duo with 5-week post-petal, and maybe cover some of the alternaria and the rust issues for the grower at that point in the season. So
just kind of looking at how we had this last season of wet weather kind of late in there, that might be an optimal time for that of the first application then coming back in with this new registrant and being able to knock that out kind of after the fact there.
Yes, no. Us having Miravis Prime on almonds, it will change the market like it did in pistachios. If people aren't familiar, we've had Miravis Prime on pistachios, and it's doing phenomenal in controlling fungal diseases on pistachios already. So we kind of know where it's going to go, and we're happy about that.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Unused prescription opioid pain medicines can spell trouble. They can spell risk if taken by someone they weren't prescribed for, harm if accidentally taken by a child or pet, or overdose if they're not used as directed. Safely dispose of opioids before they can hurt your family. Find a drug take-back option such as medicine drop boxes. You may find these in your community, at local pharmacies or police stations. Visit www.fda.gov/drug-disposal.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
Ligus proved to be a significant issue for cotton growers this year. Cooperative Extension Specialist with UC Davis, Ian Grettenberger, said they are continuing to look at mitigation approaches for Lygus problems.
We had a really bad issue this year. It wasn't surprising to people, but basically we had a very long, cool, wet winter functionally, and that really builds up their populations in non-crop areas in the hills, and then they can move into the valley and eventually end up in cotton. And so this year we saw some pretty bad issues, very heavy damage, and it was a real battle for growers and PCAs managing Lygus this year. I think overall, nobody will really know the extent of the damage from the season, primarily caused by Lygus, but I'd say contributed from the poor planting conditions in the spring. But we won't really know the extent of the damage until everything is harvested and ginned. And overall, we're continuously trying to evaluate insecticides, evaluating, you know, the best fit for the materials we do have, evaluating new materials as they come down the pipeline, which we have been evaluating some newer materials that aren't registered. So the one material that we have been working with was isocycle serum is the active ingredient. It's being marketed under the trade name Clonazolin by Syngenta. And we've worked with that one for 2 years now. And in cotton, for Lygus, it has looked very good. Great efficacy. And for the 1 year that we've had yield data, also looked very good.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Research investments spur new agricultural markets. The USDA's National Institute of Food and Agriculture announced an investment of almost $22 million in agricultural economic research. That research will include agricultural markets, international trade, farm labor, consumer behavior, nutrition, food retail, agricultural production, processing, and agricultural policy. NIFA Director Manjeet Misra says, quote, "The challenges facing the agricultural sector, their production and consumption of food, and the management of natural resources and the environment continue to evolve." The agency chief also says NIFA supports research that investigates the increasing global demands for food production in the face of limited resources and changing climate. He adds, quote, "These will all have major implications for how we use natural resources, promote healthy diets, invest in science, and foster economic opportunities, as well as the quality of life for all Americans." He made the announcement in Colorado during a keynote address at the Global Forum for Rural Advisory Service annual meeting in Denver. NAFB contributed to that report.
An update on the situation in Ukraine. A steady stream of ships is hauling grains and metals from Ukraine a month after the first inbound vessel sailed through its new shipping corridor in the Black Sea in defiance of Russian threats. Matt Ammerman, Commodity Risk Manager, Vice President of Eastern Europe Black Sea Region with StoneX Financial, gave an update during a webinar.
This is a good thing. Obviously, they're not being hit by anything. There was one that got hit by a mine, I believe it was last week. But again, the market just didn't really care about it because it's amazing the resilience of Ukraine, how quick they go back to operating. But right now, most of these vessels are a mix of products. But there are rumors of anywhere from 10 to 30 cargoes that China bought of Ukraine corn.
Ammerman says farmers in Ukraine are in the process of planting winter wheat. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
The publication arm of the American Farm Bureau Foundation for Agriculture's latest book offers a detailed look at how potatoes are planted, grown, and harvested. Illustrator Chloe Burgett says the book from Feeding Minds Press, Potatoes for Pirate Pearl, explores a potato farm.
It's an amazing story of a pirate that runs ashore on a potato farm. And you get to explore the potato farm with Pirate Pearl, and the farmer shows you around and all the different aspects of growing potatoes.
Burgett visited a potato farm to draw inspiration for illustrating the book.
Feeding Minds Press sent me to a potato farm in Utah, and I met this farmer named Tyson. It was a really inspiring trip. He showed me around his family's farm that had been in his family for six generations, and I dressed as Pirate Pearl so I could explore his farm as a pirate. The farmer is named Farmer Faye, and she shows Pirate Pearl around her farm. And I designed her as an older woman because it was really about her handing down this generational knowledge of farming.
She says books like Potatoes for Pirate Pearl offer an important look at where food comes from.
There's a scene in the book where Pirate Pearl and Farmer Faye are figuring out all the different ways they can cook potatoes. And I think learning where those potatoes came from and how they got to the kitchen is something really special. And it's something that you don't just think about when you're reading a book at story time, but you would think about in your own kitchen when you're getting out your ingredients and you wonder, like, where did this stuff come from? So I think it's a special connection point that children and just people can make every day.
Learn more and order the book at feedingmindspress.com. Michael Clements, Washington.
Coming soon is a U.S. agricultural trade mission to Southeast Asia. USDA's Gary Crawford talks with Undersecretary of Agriculture Alexis Taylor in this next report.
Southeast Asia.
I think this is a very exciting part of the world.
And Undersecretary of Agriculture for Trade Alexis Taylor is preparing to lead a U.S. ag trade mission to that part of the world, Southeast Asia. On the mission with her, leaders of three State Departments of Agriculture and representatives from 29 U.S. ag organizations and businesses. The group will visit Malaysia and Singapore, but there will be meetings and contacts with officials and buyers from other Southeast Asian nations. Alexis Taylor says the market potential of that region huge.
They have growing economies, and they have a generally young population. So we have the ability today to build trading relationships, to help our producers get into those markets, to build those long-term relationships and create lifelong consumers of American food and agriculture products.
That's the goal of the four-day mission, which starts October 30.
Thanks, Gary. For more on trade missions, you can visit fas.usda.gov.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit Agnet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at Agnet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the Agnet News Hour from Agnet West. Agnet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.